Hello there, podcast land. Episode 105 featuring Dan Briggs is brought to you by, you guessed it, Silence and Solitude. Based out of Southern New Jersey, Silence and Solitude is a metalcore quintet that consists of Shane Roxas, Colby Hempel, Cody Mitchell, Alexander Coates, and Justin Popper. The band, formed in early 2015, made their debut in September of the following year, having spent the previous year writing and recording. They released their debut album, Resurgence, in December of last year, 2016, which debuted at number 22 to the zero on iTunes Metal Charts. They have released music videos for their singles, Suffering, Deceiver, and for their cover of Mariah Carey's, yep, let's sing it together, All I Want for Christmas Is You. There we go. I'm starting to get on key now. From New Transcendence, they had to say, Resurgence is a must-listen for 2016, without a doubt, especially for fans of metal and its subgenres. If you're looking for something that is emotionally powerful, but not too whiny, aggressive, but not hate-filled, and will stand the test of time, this is the album you've been searching for. For more information, visit www.silenceandsolitude.com. Episode 105 is also brought to you by Old Self. Based out of Toms River, New Jersey, Old Self fleshes out ambient rock melodies with poetic arrangements while using people's stories as the concepts and lyricism for their songs. They help bring people's dark thoughts to the public in a very unique manner. Their hope is to reach out to not only their fan base, but to everyone they come across with in a therapeutic way. Recently pairing up with the nonprofit organization A Voice for the Innocent, they are working on furthering their outreach in hopes they can help as many people as they can in a positive way through music. For more information, they're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Old Self Official. Episode 105 is also brought to you by From the Deafs. But of course, who else would it be? From the Deafs has formed in 2012 and is a five-piece metalcore band hailing from northern New Jersey. They have two releases under their belt, their EP The Last Time, and their full-length Animosity. Along with playing shows as much as possible, they're writing more music for another release coming in the near future. For more information, they're on facebook.com/FromTheDeafsNJ, twitter.com/FromTheDeafsNJ, and instagram.com/FromTheDeafsNJ. Now let's get right into it. Today, Kevin is back, and he's speaking with Dan Briggs. He is the bassist of the progressive metal band Between the Mother Effin' Buried and Me, and it starts right now.
From out of the wasteland of generic podcasts and radio shows, one has emerged. It prides itself on having conversations with the most talented musicians from all over the world. If you like a boring question and answer interview, this isn't for you. If you want deep conversations about anything and everything, you've come to the right place. Your new favorite show starts now, and its name is Behind the Barricade.
All right, Mr. Briggs. Well, good morning. And again, thank you for joining me to this, you know. So... Let's talk about Colors, right? We're celebrating the 10-year anniversary of that album. I listened to it for the first time last night, and it was fairly early enough that I managed to listen to it twice. That album is a twist, man. It feels like all these different genres thrown into a blender and then spat right back out.
Yeah, it was, at the time, you know, it was a really big musical statement for us. And it was kind of, you know, an important step in, getting us recognized in the, you know, progressive rock and metal world. On that album, we toured with Dream Theater and Opeth and Meshuggah, and you know, I don't think we would have been able to do that had we not written that album. So that kind of opened up a big door for us creatively, and kind of fueled the next 5 or 6 years of records, and then, you know, before we kind of like dug deep and open a new door.
Yeah, absolutely. From what I understand, Colors was probably your most was probably the commercially successful breakout record, right?
No, I think Alaska's sold the most records just because of the time, you know, when it came out. It came out when people were still buying a lot of CDs and stuff.
Right.
But, you know, Colors, I think has resonated a lot with fans. I think it's when a lot of people came on board, and then, you know, it was, you know, like I said, just kind of like opened up a lot of new doors for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember you gave an interview on Reddit about how you first wrote this, you know, by working on the instrumentals, you know, right after Ozfest, right?
Yeah, kind of, you know, during it. I mean, you know, we've talked about it for 10 years now, but, you know, Ozfest pretty much spurred the album out of an extreme hatred of our situation, and just wanting to really let loose and really go nuts. You know, that was just a weird and rough summer for us. And you know, the song White Walls is you know, kind of directly about that. So, kind of fitting that it closes out the album. But yeah, you know, did some writing on that. And then when we got home from that tour, we put together Ants of the Sky, and then we went, I think, through to the end of the record. We did Ants of the Sky, prequel to the sequel, Viridian, White Walls, and then started back probably near the beginning, because I think the last song we wrote was Son of Nothing, which bridges into Ants of the Sky. So we kind of worked that way, which was bizarre, but it was the first time that we you know, wrote in terms of a full album instead of just a collection of songs. So that was another big thing for us, because that's kind of what we do now.
Yeah, like when I was listening to the album, it kind of feels like it just blurs together as one, you know, single track. And while that's something that, you know, a lot of different artists try to go for on, you know, different styles, of course, but here it kind of felt as if the songs were, in fact, set up so you could listen to one song and without looking at the track list, you know, wait for maybe like 20, 30 minutes and, you know, be on the other end of the album but still thinking you're listening to the same song. You can easily get lost in the record, right?
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it, and it's something that we love and that, you know, kind of got lost for a little while, but maybe it's coming back with some people. But, you know, when I get something, I mean, I'm not searching around to track 5 or 7 or whatever. Like, I drop the needle on the thing and I listen, you know, to a side. I flip it over, or, you know, I press play in my car and I listen to a whole record. And, you know, if you can't write a record that's good from start to finish, you know, and just put a couple good ones and then a bunch of filler, you know, I mean, that sucks. You know, we grew up with, you know, 90s rock, where there were a lot of records like that, you know, where the hits somehow were really good and then the other songs were just kind of like throwaways, which makes the records that really lived on from that time so important, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that just kind of harkens back to, you know, what we love, you know, at that time, you know, it was really, you know, like Dark Side of the Moon, Scenes from Memory by Dream Theater. Those were big albums at that time for us.
Yeah,
for sure.
I remember listening to actually just the opener track, and I thought I was actually listening to the intro to The Dark Side of the Moon.
When I was
actually growing up, my father was a massive Pink Floyd fan, and he insisted that we get grown up, my brothers and I, on, you know, that kind of music.
You know? Yeah, it's so important. My girlfriend and I are going to see Roger Waters this summer, and that's the first time I've ever seen any member live. Oh. And it looks like he's still doing very, you know, creative work you know, kind of using that music as the landscape, but really pushing it still, which is great.
Yeah, like, you know, like, that actually brings me to a couple of things about Between the Buried and Me that I actually like to ask you about, right?
Uh-huh.
So first you mentioned earlier on that that the album was created out of an extreme hatred of your guys' situation. What was your situation? Like, just, I'm a little
bit confused. It was just really being clumped in, like, in a world that we just didn't quite feel right at, you know? We were sitting at Ozfest, you got 20 minutes to play for people, and they're trying to understand a band like us, and you know, the people there that worked there were so shitty, and they were so rude to the bands on the side stage, and you know, it's just like they, you just didn't feel like you belonged. You're kind of wondering what you're doing, you know, and and all the while seeming like you're just not making an impact on anyone at the fest that you're playing to at, you know, 9:30 in the morning or whatever. So
it kind of feels like you're, you know, just playing to a bunch of just, you know, bodies. You're not, nobody's getting down to your music. Nobody's really, you know, getting into it.
Yeah, so it, you know, I think there was just a lot of, there was a lot of frustration and a lot of just like, holy shit, I just want to do something so different.
Right.
That summer, and just sitting on the bus, just sweating profusely because there's no air conditioner, and
that's awful.
Sitting in the back lounge with your guitar, just you know, writing these weird instrumental bits, you know, that would become White Walls or Sun and Nothing or whatever.
Yeah.
Going from there.
So, and as you guys actually get closer to playing this 10-year anniversary tour, what do you think it will be like based on where you guys are as a musician? Because as I understand it, Coma Ecliptic was the biggest step away from being the, you know, mathcore-y, you know, prog metal that you guys have basically...
Well, we've been taking steps, you know, forward our whole career, so it really wasn't, you know, that big of a shift or anything. If we'd done that shift right after Colors, it might have been, but we've got a whole, you know, we've got, you know, 8 or 9 albums in our catalog, so it's, you know, it was just going to happen that when we're in our 30s, we'll probably be writing different music than we were in our early 20s, but it's all been a natural shift.
Yeah, like, I just remember an interview from that album release in which you guys described as a, you know, a conceptual, actually, just as you said earlier in this recording, that it was a new door opening, that it was a new direction for the band to be taken. So that's why I suppose I'm curious about what is that disparity between the images of what the band used to be when you wrote Colors and between what it is now in Coma Ecliptic, you know, post-Coma Ecliptic.
It's just growing. I mean, we're a progressive band, and we're true to what that means. You know, it's not just a genre term for a sound of music. It's an ideology, and we're just constantly growing, and our sound is, you know, this living, you know, kind of organism that's constantly taking on different forms, and that's what makes it exciting to us, and I think that's what's been exciting to our fans over the years, and they've grown a lot with us too.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people who said, you know, we introduced them to this whole world, and that's great, because I had those bands, you know, when I was in high school and just getting into progressive rock and stuff, so it's exciting and it's important, you know. And the bands we look up to, you know, bands like Radiohead, they're constantly reinventing themselves and doing something different, and that's really inspiring. You know, King Crimson the same way. It's like, you know, Robert Fripp would take really extreme measures where, you know, once he felt like he'd gotten as much out of a version of their band as he could, he would just, you know, fold it. And then the band would reform 5 years with a new vision. And, you know, thankfully for us, we've just been able to grow while still touring and, you know, doing records with other bands and, you know, coming back every couple of years and working on between the Baird and Me stuff, and you know, there's just a natural growth.
Yeah. So what I'm getting from this is that when you guys play, you know, your 10-year anniversary tour, it will be just, it'll just be revisiting that material again.
Uh-huh.
And just playing it live. Tell me about your live performance. Tell me about how BTBAM can takes this album and translates it live, or at least plans to.
Yeah, that's kind of just our thing, is we like to pretty much do what's on paper. I guess kind of more in the sense of like a classical performance. You know, we meticulously, especially on that album, you know, because it changes so much so often that from a bass perspective, you know, my parts, I play, you know, note by note exactly, and we're just the kind of band that takes pride in, you know, a good show for us is really just slaying the material.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's like our thing. There's not like really room in that set for improvisation, but you know, thankfully I get that from other bands that I do, so
right,
they get that balance.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I got it. Now I've been thinking about your musical career, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, it started out, as I understand it, you started out playing the saxophone, and then you've been playing the bass. You've kept the same brand of bass that you got when you were 16.
Yeah, thankfully Spectre ended up being a great company that makes fantastic instruments, and little did I know that when I was 16 and went to Sam Ash in Cleveland to get a 5-string bass with 24 frets, that's what I was getting into. And it's funny, I've had a great relationship with them professionally for 12 years, and as a dingus bass player for 16 years, for half my life.
A dingus bass player in a primarily guitar-driven metal band that still allows you to get heard through on solos and, you know, these and little echoes, but they're still, despite being only echoes, they're still very, you know, pronounced moments where I feel like when I'm hearing through Viridian especially, like, that song stands out to me the most.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that song was just written as a build-up to White Walls. I had the beginning of White Walls written, and I guess coming out of Prequel to the Sequel, it ends, and we needed to have a chord progression that kind of slowly modulated throughout it to get to the key that White Walls is in, and thus that track happened. But yeah, it was neat. You know, Paul wrote the chords, and I did a little, I tried to do my best, you know, at the time, Jaco Pastorius influenced little lead, and that's what it was.
Yeah, no, I don't understand, I personally haven't heard a lot of different, you know, progressive bands, you know, at least, you know, in the range of Pink Floyd and King Crimson and all of these, you know, classics. I've been thinking about the new Mastodon record though, but I've still yet to understand where all of these, you know, different influences are being drawn from, the Moog synths and the and the vocal lines and the drumming. Oh man, the drumming.
Yeah, Blake was going off at that point.
Yeah, so is it possible, do you think, that I could ask you to look back at this album, Colors, right, and sort of review it for me, in a sense, in a few words, just sort of, you know, I don't know.
Well, there's some great reviews out there from the time, because that's kind of when I stopped. That was the second record, I guess third if you count the covers record that we did, but that this lineup did, and that was when I kind of stopped reading reviews, because, you know, the album was kind of dogged for, you know, all the things that I felt like, you know, our fans and people kind of got excited about, like that there was, you know, bluegrass mixed in with some 90s rock sounds, mixed in with, you know, psychedelic 60s sounds, mixed in with death metal or Dream Theater or yada yada. And sounds to like us, it was just music. It was just what we dug. But it was kind of funny at the time that was the stuff that got dogged on. And what was funny was, you know, a song like Ants of the Sky, so people would dog on the bluegrass part, and it's like, you know, not that we have to argue it, because obviously 10 years ago, I guess people like it or whatever, but you're like, it's just the chorus just done in a bluegrass variation as acting as a pre-chorus, you know. To us, it just made sense stylistically, like, why wouldn't we do that? You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know, just five guys in their early 20s just having fun. I mean, that was the first time we really had fun writing. When we wrote Alaska, it was very like trying and weird. It was like the five of us were in the room together for the very first time, you know, and everyone came in with ideas and sheet music and stuff and was trying to get their voice heard. You know, I was all hopped up on Queen and Oingo Boingo and King Crimson and this shit, and these guys are like, you know, I'm just trying to ease those ideas onto them, and now, you know, now all these years later, those sounds aren't weird. But at the time, you know, writing Alaska or something, you know, they were pretty, you know, it was just new sounds, and it just seemed that after 2 years of touring on Alaska that we gelled a lot as a band, and by the time we went into the rehearsal space with all the sheet music, all the stuff that we had to do, colors, that it just happened. It happened.
Absolutely.
Real quick, and was, you know, a smooth recording experience. It was really easy, and we went out on tour the day the record came out, I think, and we just played it from okay. that day on. We had yeah. basically no fear. We were like, yep, we did this thing the last year. We're super stoked on it, and here it is.
Naturally.
And thankfully, people didn't reject it.
Yeah, and now I'm getting the idea. Now I'm sort of getting an image from you guys, like, you know, sort of what between the buried and me, you know, between what people see it as, and between what you guys try to export yourselves as, right?
Yeah, we're just like five idiots who
yeah.
love, you know, coffee and vegan food and sports and dogs and stuff. Yeah,
we're
not that cool.
All the essentials.
yeah, pretty much.
It's actually the most interesting thing. I first heard of you guys back in like my middle school years, right? Like about to finish college, but I remember my brother had bought a Hawthorne Heights CD, right?
I know where this is going.
Yeah, you know where this is.
You
know
a this rogue is. BT Bam
there's
CD
a, yeah.
or track.
Yeah, it was just, you know, five of you guys, and one of you is speaking in like this really thick country accent.
Oh, weird. Yeah.
This right here is Alaska.
Whoa, weird.
Yeah.
That's probably Dusty, our guitarist. That's funny.
Probably Dusty.
Weird.
And I remember I listened to it and I was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, that was Victory's like genius campaign. They're like, yo, someone's gonna buy this pop punk record and they're gonna love this Between the Buried Me track. You know?
They had so much weird stuff on that sampler, so it wasn't really a far cry so much as, oh, here's like, you know, pop punk and all of a sudden like this death metal destructive, you know, force
yeah.
of Tommy Rogers.
At the time,
growling.
That's what was kind of like, you know, like attractive about Victory was that they had bands of so many different styles. And I know when Tommy and Paul signed before we joined, you know, that was kind of what fueled it, is that like, oh, well, we're going to stick out on this label, but kind of not in a bad way, just kind of like in a way that like every band kind of sticks out. And then it just turned out they do shady, horrible business and own the rights to more than most of our catalog. So
wow.
That's great.
Yeah, I've been keeping up with the Data Remember feud.
That's quite the story, isn't it?
Oh, man, it's
crazy.
And apparently when Bad Vibrations got released, Victory apparently, you know, put up, advertised for ADTR, and the band went ballistic.
That's weird. Yeah, who knows, man?
Oh,
who knows?
Dude.
Few screws loose.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It's just crazy, and I'm glad to know. I'm glad that all of you, that it sounds like you guys are out of that now.
Yeah, we've done 3 releases on Metal Blade since 2011, maybe, and it's been great. So much different working environment.
And since then, you guys have gone on to tour with bands such as Good Tiger and August Burns Red. You know, this solid blend of what seems to be like, you know, slamming metalcore and progressive rock and BT BAM all in one package. Do you remember that tour?
Yeah, that was just last year.
That was
last spring.
That was last.
I was there.
Wow, that was a year ago.
Yep.
It seems like it was back in 2015 or whatever. But yeah. What was that like, you know, just, you know, being on, you know, this, I don't know, not necessarily left field, because because August Burns Red and Good Tiger both are, you know, experimental enough to be a little bit closer into your radar, but...
Yeah, well, before I answer this, it'll probably be the last one, just because I have an interview in 5 minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, we have the same management as August Burns Red, and we toured with them... Like, let's see, what year was last year? We had toured with them, like, 10 years before, I think, 2006, and then I think in, maybe in, I guess, 2007, after Colors came out, they were on the second run of the Colors tour with us, and we've just been friends, you know, for years, and then Good Tiger, you know, a lot of the guys were in a band called, Safety Fire beforehand.
Right, that was one of the guitarists.
They were just great friends of ours. We took them on a couple tours. So we were psyched, you know, that they started a new band, and we were able to get them on what I think was their first U.S. tour. If I remember now, I think that was their first U.S. run. So that was great, and now they've stayed, you know, super busy ever since. So
I see.
Not a bad way, you know, get your buds over to America for a little springtime tour.
Naturally. And as we begin to close this tour out, because I know you have another one coming up, like, immediately, is there anything else that you'd like to plug as we begin to close this out? You've been very good to me as somebody to interview. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I had a record come out 2 weeks ago with my new group called Nova Collective, and it's just, you know, it's freaky, futuristic fusion stuff with some members of Between the Buried and Me and Haken.
Okay.
And we're getting that off the ground this fall as well, doing some touring. So be on the lookout for that, as well as, you know, BT BAM, Comecliptic DVD, and Colors Tour, and new record. It's not going to stop. Just going to keep coming. The hits keep coming.
It's not going to stop, and you guys still find ways to be creative, even as, you know, creativity, you know, becomes an exercise in, you know, in this labored exercise.
Yeah, no, it's fun. That's like the fun part of my life.
Is that
being creative?
You guys can still cut loose and not take yourselves too seriously while still crafting a serious, you know, hard hitting metal record that's, you know, weird and spongy and fun. Yeah, I can get down with that. Where can people find you on the social media spectrum?
I guess on Twitter I'm Dan Briggs X.
All right.
That's me.
Straight edge and vegan.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit. And to anyone listening, you can find me at Grand Theft Academia, that's GRNDTHFTACDMIA, and on Instagram at Pereira.K. Dan, thank you again so much, and I hope to speak with you guys later. Take it easy.
Yeah, thanks, man. See ya.
Bye.
Just keep waiting. You just keep waiting.